Hello and welcome back to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Garrett Heilman. I'm the head of research at Blockchain.com and a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. A major crypto asset theme this past quarter is the rise of the so-called alt layer one trade. During the third quarter, the price of native tokens for blockchain networks like Solana, Avalanche, and Tezos all significantly outperformed the two largest layer one protocols, Ethereum and Bitcoin. These alternatives to Ethereum and Bitcoin often feature lower fees and other functionality that make it faster and cheaper for some rapidly growing crypto asset use cases. Indeed, one of the biggest crypto growth drivers in Q3 has been the rise of non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, and these can often more quickly and cost-effectively be minted on blockchains other than Ethereum. We have an upcoming webinar later this month where we'll be providing an intro to NFTs and why they are viewed as such an important innovation in crypto. But today we're excited to share with you a recent conversation that Blockchain.com co-founder Nick Carey and I had with Kathleen Brightman, who co-founded the Tezos blockchain with her husband, Arthur Brightman. On this episode, we discuss the core blockchain and smart contract problems Tezos is aiming to solve and why these problems are so important. We discuss Kathleen's background and how her experience in traditional finance shaped her outlook about the future of financial services and blockchain technology. And we talk about what's new with Tezos and Kathleen's perspective on the current NFT craze.
So we're extremely lucky to have Kathleen Brightman with us today. I've known Kathleen for probably like 6 or 7 years now. And so I'm really excited to have her join us for a conversation today. Kathleen Brightman was a co-founder of Tezos. She has been the architect of that network, which leverages a proof-of-stake mechanism to provide high security and low energy usage compared to other popular cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum. So we're going to want to talk a little bit about that today. Since the Tezos mainnet launch in September 2018, Tezos has been selected by Société Générale, which is a major financial institution in France as part of its central bank digital currency project. So really interesting stuff we need to talk to Kathleen about there. They've been named a technology partner for Microsoft India, selected by the Red Bull Racing team for using NFTs for their esports efforts, and tapped by the International Organization for Migration, a related organization to United Nations, to anonymously collect worker information to improve conditions in the garment manufacturing sector in Thailand. In addition to doing all of that with Tezos, Kathleen is a founder of Coast, a company building blockchain-powered collectible game cards. She has also worked at Accenture, Bridgewater Associates, and the Wall Street Journal, and holds a degree from Cornell University. Kathleen was named to Fortune's 40 Under 40. She's spoken all over the world at events like South by Southwest, MIT's Technology Review, and many more. And she's a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Future Council on Cryptocurrencies. So, without further ado, welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Nick. What a kind and gracious introduction. And really going through my resume and then some. So, thank you.
Sorry, I hope that wasn't too awkward. We've got a little tradition here. We always like to go back to the beginning. And the first question we always ask our guests is, how did you earn your first buck or pound or euro or peso? So, what was your story and how did you earn your first buck?
Sure. There's earned and then there's earned, right? And I guess there's there's a little bit of it's a tell for what you pick as much as what you ask, right? My first job where I was on the books was at Nordstrom. It was fall of 2007, and I was mostly stacking jeans in their jeans department. It gave me a profound distaste for Uggs, which were very much in fashion that fall. And so I had to help out in the shoe department a few times, and I said, man, retail is tough. So I quickly got back to school and was like, I don't know if I could do that. As much as I love clothes, I hate working in retail. So that gave me a taste for other things in life. My first job on the books was at Nordstrom. Prior to that, like my father is a contractor, and that basically means he goes through different work bids and contracts, to state the obvious. And my dad used to basically pay me at a commission if I would find contracts for him in New York City that he would win. So there was a bit of a finder's fee, and I got to, you know, learn about sales and all that good stuff. I was not very successful, which is why I wound up working at Nordstrom. But you know, it was a good concept, right? Like, you know, my father was a small businessman, and I think it was a good lesson in eat what you kill. Even though I was very bad at it. So I could have earned my first buck that way, but instead I went into retail.
Nice. Yeah, I was a shoe dog too in the early retail days. So I understand the experience. Cool. So you, after that and your early young adult career, went into traditional finance. Can you talk a little bit about how that experience sort of shaped your thinking about the world of wealth and money, and also how that sort of prepared you to kind of mentally flip your model when you learned about cryptocurrencies?
Sure. I mean, the year was 2012. I was working at a venture capital fund, and I said, I'm not making enough money. So the VC said, sure, if you could find a job that pays you more, we might be able to match it. And so I went out and I interviewed at a bunch of places, and I got a job offer from Bridgewater Associates, which is like the world's largest hedge fund. So Bridgewater is kind of funny because it is gigantic. It also has a very particular culture, as embodied by Ray Dalio's book Principles, which I think was a New York Times bestseller for some point in the 2017-2018 period. I don't know where it ranks now, but I digress. I got a job offer there, and I went back to the VC fund, and I was like, well, these guys are going to pay me this much. And so the VC fund says, we're not going to match that, so you should just take this job. And I said, damn it. So that was why I accepted the offer there. It was a very odd period of my life. Basically, Bridgewater has this very distinctive culture where they care a lot about truth. And I was a philosophy major, so I was able to like kind of parry with that and talk about all the different ways there were truth. But you know, the fact of the matter is, it was basically an hour and a half long commute from my apartment. So honestly, the best part about Bridgewater for me was that I got to read for 3 hours a day. And that's more or less all the stuff I learned was on the commute there and back rather than anything there. But I think, you know, there's sort of this halcyon view, if you don't work in traditional finance, that it's this sort of very efficiently run machine that is sort of has all this money pumped into it. It has all these sophisticated actors within it. But if you actually look at like the global financial system, it's kind of a weird, very specious, speciously oriented, I guess, machine. And this was, I guess, 2013, mid-2013. And I actually got really into Bitcoin as a consequence of this, mostly on the commute there and back, not because anyone at Bridgewater was talking about Bitcoin, but because I was just, you know, kind of bored out of my skull for 3 hours a day. And there's something kind of like provocative about Bitcoin as an alternative to traditional finance that I think you only really, really appreciated in 2013. If you kind of saw that the innards of traditional finance are a bit wonky, mostly shaped by like the last few hundred years and not necessarily by new and innovative technology.
Interesting. And of course, your old boss, Ray Dalio, is now a holder of Bitcoin after a fairly resistant period of time there. So
yeah, to be sure, he was my boss.
Interesting to watch.
Boss's boss, yeah.
Fair enough.
I couldn't even see Ray from the you know, small end of the tree that I was in. What's been great validation for Bitcoin over the last, I would say, like 2 years is that a bunch of large money managers who've been very prescient in other areas have basically come out and said, like, yeah, obviously I own Bitcoin. George Soros being, I guess, the most recent entrant into that panoply of who's who of financiers.
Yeah, I listened to Soros's presentation like 3 years ago, where he spoke a lot on crypto and was very negative about it. He didn't like it as a concept, he changed his mind rather quickly. Which I'd hopefully love to hear some more of his like thesis development on that, because he certainly is a thought leader in that way that a lot of people pay attention to, especially when he changes his mind on something. So
yeah.
Anyway, it's they seem to be one after another. being increasingly convinced.
Well, I do. You know, Warren Buffett, might be like the greatest convert, potential convert. Though I think like he's never bought Microsoft stock despite knowing Bill Gates since he was like 18. So like maybe he's just like too far gone for anything that's been invented in this century.
I know that one's a bit odd. Like they are friendly. You would think that he would like support his buddy, but I guess not. So he just buys more train yards or something.
I think we can two for Soros and we're better.
All right, let's get into Tezos. What are Tezzies? How did Tezos get launched? Help our community, maybe become introduced to this project. We'd love to learn more.
Sure. So Tezos is a smart contract platform. In many ways, it's similar to Ethereum. One big difference, however, is that Tezos has a formal governance mechanism that facilitates upgrades to the protocol in a seamless fashion. So the Tezos protocol has been updated 8 times since its launch in June 2018. It does so with a very minimal amount of fanfare and drama, which is fantastic. And basically the gist of Tezos is basically born of the observation that Bitcoin lacks a mechanism to upgrade itself. So taking everything back to 2013, when I was like, slovenly going back and forth to Bridgewater, I was often reading about Bitcoin on different forums. So was my husband, Arthur, who's really an engineer's engineer. And so we were reading a lot of good arguments for Bitcoin and a lot of bad arguments for Bitcoin. And it all kind of came up to like a sort of je ne sais quoi, like, this Bitcoin thing seems really interesting. It could be really cool, but good God, its advocates and its detractors on the internet are like the dumbest people we've ever, read. So there has to be a there. So one good thing when you're like, a little bit torn about an idea or a concept is to have a bit of a back and forth and to just write down your own thoughts, right? Like that helps you, writing sometimes helps you articulate your knowledge of this specific field better than just reading. And so Tezos basically is forged after the observation that this Bitcoin thing seems really cool, but geez, there's been a lot of innovation in computer science in the last 4 years, because remember Bitcoin was launched in 2009. Wouldn't it be cool if like there was an easy way to coordinate upgrades? So this is partially born out of our relationship with the Zcash team, which had basically written a paper about how to preserve privacy in Bitcoin, which at least to me and Arthur seemed like a very obvious improvement to the protocol. If we are striving for something that looks a lot more like cash, then privacy is certainly a desirable feature. And basically the anecdote we were told was that the paper that led to the Zcash project had been presented to the Bitcoin core devs, and they more or less had said like, oh, that's a good idea, but we're going to pass, right? And so, basically what Tezos is born out of is a bit of frustration with the way the internet had interpreted Bitcoin, but also just like a fundamental belief that like research in computer science moves really quickly. And there are some properties that are so obviously good for cryptocurrencies that there should be a formal mechanism for these upgrades to take hold. The Tezos position paper, which was published in 2014, articulates this concept and then some more, as I'm sure we'll go into. Fundamentally, it's born out of the belief that technology is going to continue to move along at a quick pace, and that there needs to be a forum for I don't want to say upgrades necessarily, but more like affirming that certain properties are desirable and that they should be added in a seamless fashion. So that's Tezos, and then the native token of the ledger is called Tez or XTZ. I think the original papers called them Tezzies, but Arthur has since expressed a desire to call them Tez. So we're going to do that because I'm married to my co-founder, and that's important. But all that to say, that's basically the gist of it. More or less, how it works is that if you own a Tezos token today, you can participate in the upgrade process, and so it's a two-phase vote, which is very similar to how the Republic of Venice, basically amended itself or affirmed changes in its polity. But you know, the fun thing about Tezos is that voting process can actually itself be amended. So if we just decided tomorrow as a group, hey, actually this is a good idea in concept, but you know, in reality we'd love a supreme dictator. Obviously you could do that, though it seems very unlikely given the nature of people who come to these types of projects. But I think the original observation and its subsequent implementation is just so milquetoast and so obvious that for me it's very hard to work on anything else.
I'll hand the next question over here to Garrick.
Great. Yeah, thanks Kathleen for that great introduction to Tezos. And governance is kind of one of these topics that you know, as a research subject, it seems like it's going to be with us for a long, long time, a perennial topic. Maybe we'll never solve governance, but clearly Tezos has made some important contributions here. What have you learned around blockchain governance from the original idea to going live? And what parts of kind of the governance process would you say have been quote unquote solved, you know, versus things that may never get solved, you know? And here I'm thinking about the just natural politics and differences of opinions, and maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I think there's a few things we were afraid of that didn't come to pass. So one big concern that we had was this idea of like populism and sort of rank stupidity. Like anyone can propose an upgrade to Tezos, right? They don't even have to own tokens. And so what we were afraid of was like an influx of like snarky upgrades that would just be like completely an anathema to everyone, because that's the internet, right? Like one of the anecdotes that I think is cited in an early like Tezos text is, you know, Taylor Swift was, I guess, promoted through Walmart to give a concert at any location for a Walmart, and you just had to go online and vote, right? And she wound up having to give a concert in Alaska, right? Because you know, internet trolls kind of got what they wanted to, and they sort of voted for her to go to Alaska. Okay, good troll. So like there's no reason that can't happen in Tezos in some ways. And you know, part of our concern was that like you'd have people proposing these like kind of trollish things over and over again. But the fact of the matter is like pretty much every upgrade that has been proposed has been, I don't want to say milquetoast in the sense that like you know, there's progress moving forward. It's just mostly been technical upgrades. It hasn't been anything terribly controversial in the sense that there's a very high threshold in order to move a Tezos amendment forward. And those thresholds have overwhelmingly been met, mostly because they've been what you would call in traditional finance, secular goods, right? There would be things that like, obviously you want to have faster, you know, smart contract execution. Like who would oppose that? That's just dumb. And so it's been good that it's been mostly on the technical side of things. There have been a few upgrades that have been edging on economic interests, but it's again been mostly like in the style of, hey, we actually want this stuff to pass because things are a lot easier when we all agree. So no one has really done this sort of trollish amendment process. On the flip side of this, one thing that has been disappointing is like misinformation takes hold really easily on the internet, and it's really hard to verify certain things. So when you make a Tezos upgrade proposal, it's basically you know, just a blob of code, right, which will hopefully be part of the upgrade process. But the specification and the testing around it are things that like really technical people can do obviously quite well. But which have to be translated to the vast majority of Tezos token holders, who I assume are mostly non-technical just by looking at the numbers. So there's a, I don't want to say political campaign that has to take place regardless, but there is a political campaign that has to take place regardless. And certainly the way that this stuff is explained to people and the laity is certainly subject to like, I suppose some, it's subject to some sort of massaging, right, in one way or another. So I think, you know, some of the same concerns that we have with traditional blockchain systems are valid. Like we do put a lot more faith in people who can program in these, you know, communities than perhaps is warranted or suspected. But I hope that comes to be less of an issue over time as more people understand the systems and, you know, people gain credibility through action.
Awesome. So I want to come back to something Nick mentioned about the central bank digital currency pilot trial. And the idea of blockchains being used for what can be characterized or is often characterized as critical infrastructure, really important, you know, components, institutions in society, energy is often mentioned, critical supply chains, central bank digital currency. And can you talk about some of the technologies that Tezos employs that make it a candidate for some of these critical infrastructure projects and why you were selected for this CBDC pilot?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, there's a few things going on in your question. So I'm just gonna like try to dissect them as much as possible. The first part of it is like, hey, you know, there are these components of the global financial system that have historically been basically lines of credit between different people. And now we're talking about a potential system that is replaced with open source software, right? So that's kind of the gist of moving from traditional finance and all these wonky agreements and closed door meetings to something that's entirely public, which is the blockchain. So I see this as a good thing, and I'm sure you do too in some form. But the fact of the matter is, this is an industry that's existed for about 10 years. And congrats, Nick, on making a company that has survived and thrived for 10 years. That's no small feat. But all that to say, like by even you know. Software comparisons, you know, blockchain technology is very new. And so the idea of upending a system that has been built and cultivated over hundreds of years, which is like basically our version of traditional finance, which, you know, obviously we can date these things however much we want, but basically the idea of moving value for you know, across many different places, you know, using intermediaries has existed since like medieval times, and since travel was you know, a possibility. And so the idea of upending this system, which has been built piecemeal over time with something that's an open source piece of software, is kind of controversial in its own right. The second tension there is that central bank digital currencies kind of have the exact opposite use case of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is basically designed to be censorship resistant, and it's designed to not be controlled by any one person effectively. And then you've got central bank digital currencies, which are effectively a way for central banks to like have lines of credit on the internet between people and sort of have some insight and some purview into it. So there's a few tensions there that like kind of go against what the goal of cryptocurrencies are, but effectively, you know, the Banque de France, which is kind of like one participant in the EU, you know, basically has been experimenting with public cryptocurrencies, and one of the ones that they chose was Tezos, and I think this was a testament to the fact that Tezos is built with security in mind. So the original team that built out the protocol comes from largely the French tradition at INRIA, which is one of the like stodgy, you know, institutions of higher learning in computer science in France. And that's where OCaml, the programming language that Tezos is built in, comes out of. And yeah, OCaml is basically a programming language that's strongly typed and offers a powerful type inference system. So it has an expressive syntax and semantics, including a powerful pattern matching and higher order modules, which makes it easy to concisely and correctly describe the type of logic underpinning, you know, a blockchain-based protocol. And people like this because a clear semantic is hugely important for taking a very ambiguous set of rules and, I guess, software and replacing it with something that's completely open. You need to be able to reason about these things in order to make sense of them. That's what makes this as a compelling alternative to the traditional finance options that you know, people have been talking about. So we do happen to think that like the fact that Tezos, you know, prevailing blockchain was written by people who have expertise in these types of formal semantics does make it very easy to reason about. And that makes it a very powerful candidate to actually serve as an alternative to, you know, I suppose the more sinuous way of the ways central banks would used to do things.
Yeah, that was an awesome answer to that question. And the term formal verification, might be just worth kind of mentioning that and trying to explain that and kind of lay terms for folks and why that might be important and what are some of the challenges around, OCaml as a programming language, in terms of recruiting developers and we often hear, just to kind of provide some context around that part of the question, learning solidity is this barrier for new developers to come and program on Ethereum. And if there's kind of an existing programming language that's in place that someone already knows, you can leverage or tap into that community. Can you speak to that kind of jumbled question? Sorry to kind of mix things together.
Quite all right. So, I mean, I guess I'll take it point by point and I'll try to answer each thing completely, but maybe not in the same order that you asked it. A few things. Tezos is a smart contract platform. It has a native smart contract language. So Ethereum has one called Solidity, which is based on JavaScript. And JavaScript is kind of one of the most popular languages to develop on. It's what a lot of web pages are written in. Tezos basically uses a smart contract language, which is called Meekleson, which is a mix of cat and forth. So it's a stack-based language. So it's a little bit, it's less accessible to reason about in the way that JavaScript is extraordinarily easy. Meekleson is a little bit more difficult. However, there have been, basically projects building on top of this tradition, which are more inspired by Python, which is, again, a very accessible programming language. It's so easy that even I can program in it. And so there's a few projects. One of the most popular ones is called SmartPy. And there's a few other ones in the Tezos ecosystem. So to address that point, it's actually quite easy to recruit on Tezos. What we find is basically smart people don't take very long to learn new programming languages. If you can program sort of baseline, it shouldn't be that much of an ask to learn another language. And then on top of that, Python's super accessible and there's basically ways to kind of reason about that translate over well to SmartPy and some of the other, Tezos-based smart contract languages. To go further down, basically, one of the reasons that OCaml was chosen as the base programming language for Tezos was because, effectively, Cock, which is unfortunately named, and I'm going to make Nick laugh, but basically the joke is that the French pick cock as a revenge for Claude Shannon picking bit. Basically one of the most advanced proof checking softwares is able to extract OCaml code from proofs, meaning that, you can mathematically verify the performance and behavior of certain pieces of code in Tezos much more easily because it's written in OCaml and it does kind of map well to this proof checking software, which many of the original software developers in the Tezos ecosystem are in fact PhDs and experts in. Why is this important? Well, basically, there's a lot of examples in the world of software failure. The Heartbleed bug caused millions of dollars in damages, in Bitcoin's history. And there was a bug at a high frequency trading firm in 2013 called Knight Capital. Again, like all of the people employed at these places are like actual rocket scientists who really should be working on many other things, but instead choose to work in traditional finance. That caused $500 million worth of losses. In 1996, there was a French, I think there was a French rocket called Ariane 5 that it cost, $7 billion to develop. The cargo was estimated at another $500 million. And that basically exploded because of an arithmetic overflow bug, which could have very easily been prevented with formal verification, right? Like, does this actually say the thing it's going to do? It all sounds very banal. Like, why would we have to double check our math? Well, because sometimes computers say yes, and in fact, they mean no, and that makes things blow up. So the idea with making formal verification in mind when the software was being built for Tezos was that, hey, dude, this is 2017 dollars. There are hundreds of millions of dollars being attributed to these smart contract platforms. And hey, wouldn't it be nice if we had a way to double check things super easily before we basically send these rockets off into space? And in the past week, we could think of like a few different failures in the DeFi ecosystem, right, which have cost in the orders of like 7 or 8 figures. And I guess, there's some people who just think YOLO and whatever, this is all this is all pretend anyway. But as this stuff matures, I do think it's important to basically have the same assurances that you would for a rocket launch when you're thinking about designing your software that, unfortunately, just to go back to traditional finance, if you have like a margin call or something like that with a firm that you often trade with, you can also just call up the dude on the phone and just try to reason with them. Like, there's no such thing in cryptocurrencies where once you've committed something to a smart contract, that's it. It's in the ether, right? And a lot of what's cool about traditional finance and some of the fallbacks that you have is that you do have relationships at the end of the day, right? No one's strictly trying to just dick people over, cryptocurrencies are kind of the worst part of both worlds, where code is law if you're kind of an extremist, and that does kind of erode some of the virtues of traditional finance, where you do have fallbacks just through these relationships that you need to manage. And so for that purpose, we do think formal verification is something that you should really be considering when you use a smart contract, and something you should be double checking. Now, mind you, this is a garbage in, garbage out sort of scenario. So if you just say like, oh, I formally verified it, but you didn't actually do the damn thing, like, it doesn't make a difference. But that was one virtue that we saw with Tezos, was basically designing something so it's easy to verify, or easier than average to verify, which is more than we could say for most of the other smart contract platforms, was an assurance we would like to offer people who are in the community.
Cool. Love to talk with you about how Tezos is being used. You've done some work in gaming as well. You've got a non-fungible token thesis, it sounds like, that we'd love to hear about. Talk to us about NFTs on Tezos and all of that.
Sure. So I assume your audience is familiar with what non-fungible tokens are, so I don't have to like do the whole rigmarole. But basically, NFTs are more or less a receipt or some sort of certificate of ownership that live on a blockchain. So the way that this is interesting is basically, if you have these sort of fuzzy systems before where it's kind of hard to infer provenance, it's really cool if you're able to basically have someone sign off and say like, yes, I am, Jeff Koons, and I say that you own this piece of work by me. That's something that doesn't really exist in the art world today, and in fact is like the subject of a lot of controversy and some really funny anecdotes too, but we don't have to get into that. So, basically people have been longing for these types of assurances since the web has existed, like this basic guarantee of, issuance and the ability to kind of verify these provenances, right? But also be able to trade them and prove that they're scarce. And so that's something that a blockchain uniquely adds to this beyond just digital signatures. So we've seen this take off since the beginning of the year. The art market was kind of the first thing to thrive with NFTs, because frankly, there have been a lot of extraordinarily talented digital artists who struggled to monetize themselves effectively in the absence of a cryptocurrency to help them do their accounting and also verification that they've issued a thing, right? And so that's been cool and heartening. The largest marketplace by daily active users sits on Tezos for art NFTs. It's called Hikik Nunk. It was in the tradition of Tezos things that I can't quite understand or reason about. It was created at a hackathon. It doesn't really have the traditional venture funding path that most other crypto projects have. And I think there's something quite beautiful to that. So basically what was built with Hikik Nunk was effectively scaffolding. And because a lot of AI and generative artists came to it very early on, what's been cool to watch is that a lot of the tools and explorers that have sitting upon it were actually built by the artists themselves, just saying like, hey, I like this on Hikiknook, and they gave me the tools to plug in, right? So that's a thing. And then separately from that, I think that basically the way that games were monetized and introduced to the web maps very poorly to our understanding of how games ought to work in real life, if you will. The most severe example of this was in digital collectible card games. Traditional card games are usually a footnote to Magic the Gathering, which was introduced in 1995 by Richard Garfield. And, you know, effectively, when this moved to the web, it struggled to have assets that kind of sit in physical format really easily in Magic the Gathering circles come to the web. This is for a variety of reasons, mostly just like, I don't think the technology was there for Hasbro when it introduced Magic the Gathering online. And so what I wound up doing was I basically teamed up with a bunch of Magic the Gathering OGs who are all in the Hall of Fame and much smarter than I am. And I said, hey guys, make the game you would have loved to have seen. And we're going to have the economics sit on a blockchain, and here's why. And so that was actually really fun, because a lot of the guys who I work with don't know anything about cryptocurrencies, but all they know is that this enforces scarcity and allows them to trade assets the way that they would have in physical format for Magic the Gathering way back, you know, in the late 90s and early aughts. And so the hope is that we're able to, through better economics, make a game that's as fun as physical Magic, but in a digital format, because we can enforce scarcity and allow for these assets to trade freely using bonding curves and all the other sorts of fun crypto things. So yeah, I mean, basically just to kind of settle my thesis on NFTs, I think that the idea of digital receipts is kind of banal, but when you think about all the different industries that struggle to actually enforce this in a digital format, it transforms a lot of the web for some industries that are very much beloved, such as gaming and art. So I hope that it continues to be a focal point of the Tezos ecosystem, because it truly has attracted the right people. Tezos also has much lower fees than Ethereum and some of its competitors. And that obviously has helped with attracting people from, I guess, more developing nations to the platform. So there's a lot of people in Malaysia and Brazil and other places that are not as wealthy as the United States, which, you know, really enjoy going in the Tezos ecosystem. And that's been truly heartening to see. But you know, do I know that this is the future? I'm not entirely sure, but it certainly is a good gateway smart contract for Tezos, and for that I'm particularly grateful.
Cool. We're getting close to the end here, and we've got a few more questions we wanted to ask. One is about just your thoughts on crypto markets. We've got, you know, the price of Bitcoin up today. You know, made a new all-time high earlier this year. You know, the Tezos Foundation, I don't know what its current holdings are, but at some time it was one of, I think, the largest holders of Bitcoin. And just love to hear your thoughts on kind of where crypto asset adoption is, where prices are. I know you're a bit limited on what you can say here, but anything you can comment on as a market observer would be appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, more buyers than sellers, that's for sure. Crypto is funny, because like it goes high, it goes low, it goes up, it goes down. I won't pretend that I have any particular insight into these things, but you know, I look historically at the price of Bitcoin as a bet between its complete dominance over the internet as like a cryptocurrency and the way that we do transactions. And between that and complete it being a total joke, right? Like so basically we're going between two massive outcomes either way. And I think what's cool about the price of Bitcoin rising is that it shows an increased interest and an increased demand for it, right? What I think is going to be much cooler is to see, like, once some of these applications that incorporate programmable money, which I guess smart contracts would fall under, you know, that that would be much cooler to see how demand goes for those assets, assuming that there's some sort of adoption for applications that are based on these new paradigms for how to monetize and how to basically use the web. So Bitcoin, you know, the price is kind of it's kind of a wonky and very silly. It's a very silly marketplace. But what I find really cool is that the idea of programmatic money is taking hold a lot more. And I think that's going to be really powerful to see over the next few years.
All right, just a couple more minutes. So I'm going to ask one of the last questions. Kathleen, what's on the roadmap for the Tezos development pipeline the rest of the year? What can the community look forward to? What's getting voted on? What are you excited about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, honestly, the thing I was most excited about was the last upgrade, which included this concept of liquidity baking, which I think is super powerful and super interesting. So basically the idea is to take a portion of the block rewards and to put them into a smart contract that has a buy and sell function so that introduces liquidity as a public good, right? And I think that's awesome. Nick, you might appreciate that just as someone who owns something that has an exchange as part of its panoply of functions. But the idea of a L1 introducing liquidity for itself is just freaking awesome.
Super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So I like that. I think that was like one of the more interesting economic developments. A lot of the other upgrade proposals have been towards making the blockchain either more efficient or faster. That's obviously great. There's a big overhaul for the consensus algorithm that's going to be coming relatively soon. And that's, you know, entirely public information because it's the best and worst part of open source is that it's all working in public. So there's really not much you can hide, even if you want to. So that's hopefully going to come to the Tezos blockchain as a proposal relatively soon. Most of the upgrades have just been about making Tezos faster, the fees lower, and the smart contracts more efficient. And that has a continued tradition. But the only economic upgrades that have been like sufficiently controversial have been around liquidity baking, just because it's a little bit wonky. But I honestly think it's a huge innovation that I hope other layer ones copy in some form, because the idea of liquidity as an economic good and a public good, I think is pretty profound. And the space would be much better off if it was more liquid, even though obviously it's grown by leaps and bounds over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, especially since a lot of that liquidity is centralized in, you know, institutions that are harvesting significant fees off of that. Cool. Okay. You would think in a ministry that's concentrating on decentralization, that would be an issue. Exactly. All right, last question, but it's going to go to both of you. Kathleen mentioned earlier that having time to read was really important, you know, early on, and I imagine still is in doing the deep thinking. What my last question to both of you, and Garrick, you're not getting away without answering this one too, is what are you currently reading and what's on your bedside table?
Oh, geez. I have a very dorky answer that has nothing to do with cryptocurrencies.
Yes.
But I have a good friend who just published a book called Tuscany, the Age of Empire. So I'm reading that, and it's like a long slog, but it's really entertaining. And there's a lot of $10 words. So I have to read it next to a dictionary. So yeah. Those are the two things next to my bedside is Tuscany, the Age of Empire, and like, you know, Oxford Dictionary.
Nice. Garrick, you've always got surrounded by piles of books. What are you reading these days?
Yeah. No, I'd like to bring down one if I could find it. It's actually about pumas or mountain lions.
A dorky answer.
Cougars. Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by these creatures. They, contrary to many other big cats, are making a comeback. They're known as the ghost cat, and they're doing well in places like California and other parts of the United States. And they're real survivors. They're amazing creatures. You know, and if you're lucky enough to ever see one, I would think it would be lucky, frankly, because they're hard to find. That would be an amazing experience. But yeah, very fascinating creature. It's nice to hear a positive story about a big, you know, predator, you know, kind of making it in this ever-changing world.
Garrick, I thought I would get the nerdiest answer, but you really outdid me on this one.
I'm an animal lover, so yeah, now you know.
Cool. Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing these insights across your career and your time raising the Tezos community and the foundation with your husband, Arthur. Amazing to see all the progress you guys have made. And thank you for your contributions. Garrick as well, thank you very much. This will be posted on our YouTube channel. I will be taking clips of it and putting those into a podcast as well as the stream being reviewable on our Facebook channel. So thank you everyone for joining us today. Special thanks to Kathleen and the team at blockchain.com for putting this on in the background. Cheers, everyone.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you're enjoying our podcast, please rate us and leave a review, as it really helps boost our visibility to more listeners.